You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we learn what powers state law gives the governor and state agencies in a public health emergency. Our partners at WisContext give us the details. First, there was supposed to be a national webinar yesterday with guidance on school closures. That virtual event, intended to help school leaders around the country, was to be hosted by the CDC and the American Association of School Administrators. Shortly before the scheduled start time, the CDC pulled out. Schools around Wisconsin and the United States have been closing to help stem the spread of the novel coronavirus, but our next guest reports that school leaders feel like they're not getting clear guidelines on how they should react to the outbreak. Aaron Richards is a national education reporter for USA Today. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, glad to be here.
Let's start with that seminar, that webinar that wasn't. What happened?
So the School Superintendents Association that represents superintendents in big districts and small districts around the country was ready to get on the horn yesterday with the CDC to provide some more guidance about how schools should be shutting down completely or operating with kids spaced apart. At the moment, you have competing guidance from the Trump administration, which has said don't gather in groups larger than 10. The CDC has said no groups larger than 50. And any schools that are still open right now would technically be running, you know, afoul of that guidance. So the Superintendents Association was waiting for that guidance yesterday and alerted the media and superintendents to it. The call was canceled, likely because the CDC isn't ready to give guidance or they're not getting good guidance from the rest of the federal government. And so all the superintendents are still kind of going it alone at this point. They're making the best decisions they can based on their own, you know, what their own state leadership thinks. But there's no national guidance from above on how schools should be operating right now or not.
Right. Reading your reporting, Aaron, it sounds like this canceled webinar is just one manifestation of a big problem. People at the local level and maybe even at the state level trying to get clarity from a higher level. And in the meantime, just wrestling with the muddling through on decisions on their own. Is that a fair assessment of what many districts are seeing right now?
Yes. Now, education is inherently a local issue in America. Mm-hmm. But the problem is you've got school leaders and even state school chiefs that are desperately wanting some guidance from the federal government about how long to stay closed, about in what fashion they should operate. I was writing today, and we'll have a story going up shortly about how to serve kids with special needs, which is also a big question mark across America. And these things are all being, you know, wrestled with by local leaders in haphazard ways because there hasn't been good guidance from the federal government on it.
That said, Aaron, we know here in Wisconsin, schools have been closed down at the statewide level. What are we seeing around the country when it comes to school closures?
Well, we've got about 37 states that have shut down their schools entirely. Yesterday, we saw the first state in the nation to say that they were going to close schools for the rest of the school year. That's Kansas. In the meantime, you've got some school districts saying we're not going to offer any online services. We're just going to wait this out and maybe make up the days at the end of the year. If the closures continue, that would increasingly be unlikely, and you'd see schools need to develop some kind of remote learning plan or distance learning plan. But, of course, that gets muddied because some kids have access to the Internet and a home learning device of some kind, and many kids don't, especially if they're low income or if they have other special circumstances that they're living under. So the reality now is most kids in the country are out of school. The question mark is, what are they actually doing during the day, and will they be able to do productive things through the end of the year if schools remain closed for a long time?
Is the Department of Education giving any guidance to help answer those questions, those issues of what do kids do on a day off of school? How do we keep them learning?
Very little. I pressed them yesterday on that very issue, especially about the issue for kids with special needs. What is the guidance for districts here? What is the minimum they can provide? What are the options? There's limited guidance from the department. They want all kids to be served equitably if districts are offering any services at all. That also gets to be difficult. The how in that is much more difficult to parse out than the what. So there hasn't been a ton of really good information from districts coming from the federal government. And in lieu of that, you see districts trying all kinds of things. Los Angeles Unified is putting a bunch of programming on their local PBS channels for kids in elementary, middle, and high school. As at least a baseline from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., your kid can tune into a local PBS station and watch curated educational content all day long.
Aaron Richards is with us, national education reporter for USA Today. We're looking at the federal level now when it comes to school shutdowns, guidance from the Federal Department of Education and elsewhere on how schools can deal with the impact of the coronavirus outbreak. And elsewhere, there's concern about assessment testing, federally mandated, state mandated at some points. Are we getting guidance on whether it can be delayed, skipped, what?
We have gotten some guidance from the federal government. The Department of Education has said that they'll consider offering waivers for state testing. I predict with a pretty good sense in my gut that most states will not be doing state testing this year if schools stay shut down for more than a few weeks. I think it may just be a gap year where we don't have good statewide testing data. That's a little easier to skip. What's a little harder to skip is what to do with graduating seniors or rising students in high school that need to understand certain high-level content before they can enter the next grade. So what's going to happen with the credits of, graduating seniors and, rising upperclassmen to determine where they're going to be at in their education if schools stay closed down for a prolonged period?
Aaron, you also have been reporting on how this is going to impact low-income students in particular. What kind of things are you looking at?
Well, accessibility is a big one. So we know that only about half of kids in America have access to both broadband internet and a home learning device of some kind, an iPad, a laptop. Even in some wealthier households, you may have one laptop for a kid to use, but if you've got three kids and you don't have three laptops, how does everybody stay connected for multiple hours during the day? It's a real accessibility issue if you've got, kids that can't learn independently. We've also got an issue with kids that are quite young. Even people who advocate for online learning don't say that it's a great idea to put kindergarten students and first graders and second graders in front of a screen for too many hours a day. And at the same time, you've got a whole new landscape of parents who are working from home, who are trying to manage their own work responsibilities and their children's learning activities. And that's putting a whole bunch of new pressures on families that we haven't seen before in this capacity.
Speaking of accessibility, you mentioned this briefly earlier. Students with various kinds of special needs, students who might be on an individualized education plan, what are the concerns for them if we're in this uncharted world of cobbling together an online educational system?
The worry is the most vulnerable kids in America, who are kids in extraordinary circumstances, either because they have physical disabilities or mental disabilities, perhaps they're living in a homeless shelter, just disadvantage in general, extremely low income, that these kids are already the most vulnerable kids we have. They already tend to be the kids that are farthest behind in their studies and the least likely to graduate and go on to productive careers after school. So what's going to happen to them if they fall even farther behind? This whole world that we're in now is exacerbating the divide between kids who are fairly well-resourced, that have access to the internet, that can, learn independently and do some guided instruction at home. It actually presents a world of opportunities for teachers to experiment with what virtual learning can look like. But for kids who are disadvantaged, there isn't as much guidance for how to help them. And especially family members aren't as trained as teachers are, especially in big districts, at helping these kids. So the worry there is that these kids fall behind and they don't get back on track in a timely manner.
From what you've heard from the Department of Education, what kind of time frame are they talking about? Are they talking about what we're doing in the next 2 weeks or what we're doing in the next 4 months or the next year if these disruptions continue?
They have been, at the federal level, at the Department of Education, very reluctant to put any kind of time frame or timeline on this thing, not even saying if this, then that. Where I hear more of that discussion happening is among governors and state school chiefs in different states that are saying, this is what it's going to look like if we shut down for 3 or 4 months. You've got some districts that are just trying to wait it out for a couple of weeks and see if maybe this thing blows over and they don't have to develop, online learning plans for everybody. You've also got some districts that don't particularly want to put an online remote learning plan out there if they don't know how to serve special needs kids, because then they can run afoul of federal laws that require them to offer equitable access to all students. So all these things are points of discussion, but they're all happening at sort of the state and district-wide level, which means that there's just a lot of variability from state to state about the experiences that parents and kids are getting right now.
Given, as you say, the Federal Department of Education isn't necessarily the agency that's going to call the shots, is the experience you're going to have as a student, as a parent right now, just conditioned on what state you live in, what district you live in?
I do. I think it's dependent on that. I also think it's dependent on how much access you have to the ability to learn online independently and what your family structure is like. You know, who's around you and what kinds of activities or resources can you access? But absolutely, we're seeing a lot of variability from state to state and district to district, even within states. And another interesting aspect of this is that even among higher resourced communities, communities right next to each other, even in Wisconsin, where most kids are, you know, middle class and higher, even some of those districts don't have learning plans in place for kids to learn remotely. And so you're seeing a lot of variability even among the wealthier districts in the state that are, you know, where more kids are on track and performing at grade level.
In our last few moments, Aaron, what is the next piece of the story you're watching for?
After we talk today and tomorrow about the variability and sometimes lack of services altogether for special needs students, I think we'll be taking another look at sort of large-scale efforts to provide more robust learning experiences for kids. I'm also interested to see how much these mass distribution of devices, you know, iPads and laptops to students, as well as these efforts, many of them backed by corporate telecom companies to provide internet access to kids. I'm really interested in how those will play out. Also interested to see if those will last in any real capacity after this immediate health crisis is over.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you.
That's USA Today national education reporter Aaron Richards. We talked to her today about school leaders across the country looking for additional COVID-19 guidance from the CDC and Department of Education. Coming up on Friday, we'll talk to a pediatrician and literacy advocate about how to keep kids engaged and learning at home during the coronavirus outbreak. And later today, we'll talk to Wisconsin's Deputy State Superintendent of Public Instruction about what's happening here in Wisconsin. Up next, Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers used an executive order to declare a public health emergency for the state. We'll learn what that means and how it translates into action. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's congressional delegation is weighing in on top priorities on the novel coronavirus and its economic impact, things like paid sick leave and unemployment compensation. We'll talk more about that and more during our weekly check-in on national politics. First, there were 72 confirmed cases of coronavirus, also known as COVID-19, in Wisconsin as of earlier today. As the number of cases increases, state and national officials have been taking steps to respond to the global pandemic. Last week, Governor Tony Evers used an executive order to declare a public health emergency for the entire state of Wisconsin, and new reporting from WisContext examines the scope and impact of a state emergency declaration. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. He talked to WPR host Keeley Baltina about the story.
How does a governor declare a public health emergency? What's the mechanism?
The mechanism is an executive order, and that's exactly what Governor Evers did last week. He declared a public health emergency in response to COVID-19 via an executive order issued through his office.
And this is specific to this public health crisis that we're dealing with now. What is the effect of an emergency declaration? What does it let the state do?
It lets the state do kind of all sorts of things. So Wisconsin law gives the governor powers to declare emergencies in response to not only threats to public health, but to human and natural disasters, threats to vital telecommunication systems. And really, the whole purpose for declaring an emergency is to allow the state agencies, in this case, because it's a public health emergency, it's the Department of Health Services that's the lead agency. It kind of cuts red tape, loosens some regulatory requirements, and frees up monies for the response. Basically, the end goal or the primary objective is to create as speedy a response to the emergency as possible.
And so this really does rely not just on state government then, but like working up with the federal government and then working down to local agencies?
Precisely. Yes, that's exactly correct. So often an emergency declaration precedes requests for federal help. In this case, I am not sure if the state of Wisconsin has been able to secure federal help so far for the public health emergency related to COVID-19, at least in terms of procuring medications or vital equipment like ventilators. In theory, it does or it would give the state access to the federal government's strategic national stockpile, where there are billions of dollars worth of medical supplies, including ventilators and personal protective equipment like face masks. But it's unclear. I haven't been able to get an answer about whether the state has been able to procure anything from that stockpile yet. And I know that President Trump, just in the last day or so, on a phone call with governors, did inform them that they really should be looking to procure that vital equipment on their own and through local means and not to depend on the federal government. But yeah, as you said, it also allows for or it creates, better mechanisms for communication between the state and local agencies. In the case of COVID-19 and this public health emergency, it allows local health departments who might have to be spending a lot of money to enforce isolation and quarantines in communities to be reimbursed by the state.
And that's just one of the specific directions of this executive order. There were many elements of it. Give us a couple of the others that we might want to know.
Yeah. So one of the things that's a moving target and has been over the last several days is directives related to large public gatherings. At the time that this public health emergency was declared on March 12th, at that time, the secretary designee for the Department of Health Services, Andrea Palm, was only providing a recommendation that people cancel or not attend gatherings of 250 or more people. We know now that that has changed. Governor Evers has tightened the ban on large gatherings, and that may change as the days progress. That's really, really a moving target. There are other things as well. So the DHS is the lead agency, but it's certainly not the only agency responding to the public health emergency. I would say probably most state agencies are involved in some way. I know that DATCAP, that's the Department of Ag, Transportation, and Consumer Protection, lifted weight limits on highways for trucks so that there's one less barrier, I guess, to the distribution of food and vital supplies. We know that a lot of people were shopping, myself, my family included, over the last several days. And so they really want to make sure that food and vital supplies are accessible to people around the state.
Will Cushman is the associate editor of Wiscontext, and we're talking with him today about the scope and impact of a state emergency declaration. And Will, under what circumstances can the governor declare an emergency?
It's really left. It's interesting. I was studying state statutes, and it really is left up to the governor. It's at the governor's discretion to declare an emergency of any type, including a public health emergency. So it's really the governor and whoever the governor's advisors are who might be advising that call. But it's ultimately the governor's call.
You know, we've seen governors in other states mandate complete closures of bars or restaurants or, change really public gatherings significantly. In Wisconsin, do we have limits on the governor's ability to declare a public health emergency or the factors that go into a public health emergency?
As far as I can tell from state statutes and folks who I've talked to, there aren't really limits on how far the governor could go in terms of banning large gatherings or other such bans on movement, either locally or in a broad area. That's one piece of this that maybe we should talk about a little bit, is that a public health emergency, or like pretty much any emergency declared in the state, could be for the whole state, or it could be for a very specific area in the state, even just one single community. In this case, it is for the entire state. In addition to that, local governments can declare their own emergencies in response to all sorts of things, including public health. And some have done that, including in Milwaukee.
And how long might this public emergency declaration last? I mean, our timeline shifts daily with our discussions about COVID-19. How long does this declaration from Evers go on?
So an emergency declaration can last for 60 days, or it can be cut off early by the governor or by a joint resolution from the legislature. But the emergency can also be extended beyond 60 days, but that has to happen with a joint resolution from the state legislature.
And what are you watching then as we move forward under this emergency declaration?
I am really watching to see what comes next, particularly with regard to bans or recommendations on social gatherings, other directives, I guess, related to social distancing.
And this public health emergency is really a combination of health experts and politicians. So how do they navigate what the information is that they issue these declarations based on?
I think they're in constant communication with folks at the federal level. So that would be the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They're getting guidance from the World Health Organization. And folks at the DHS are also in communication with local health departments, which are really the front lines responding to this crisis. And they're really the boots on the ground to know what's happening within communities day to day.
Will, I'm sure we'll talk again soon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was Will Cushman, associate editor of WisContext. He talked to WPR host Keely Boltina about his latest piece on Wisconsin's public health emergency declaration. You can read his story online at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, COVID-19 fears are having a big impact on politics at the federal level, from primary elections to bills to help people who can't work. We'll learn more during our weekly check-in on national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, at the direction of Governor Tony Evers, all of Wisconsin's K-12 schools are closed. We'll learn how the decision was made and what support the Department of Public Instruction is providing to local districts. First, activity in Washington ramped up this week in an effort to address the COVID-19 pandemic. The White House, Congress, and various federal agencies have been working on a range of legislation, directives, and initiatives. In the midst of all that, there's still an election season going on, with primaries happening in a different form than usual. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is the most important economic move that the White House and Congress could take to help individual Americans? If you're a small business owner or work for one, what do you need to stay afloat? If you're working in the service sector, what is the near future looking like for you? What do you want to see, if anything, from Washington? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Craig Gilbert is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington bureau chief and longtime political writer. Craig, good to have you back with us.
Good to be with you.
Well, there's just been a flurry of activity, proposals from the White House, proposals from Congress. We're seeing that now the Senate has signed off on a paid sick leave bill to send it to the president. What are some of the key economic issues, measures you're seeing in the nation's capital right now?
So essentially, what the Senate did just a few moments ago is pass a piece of legislation that the House passed in recent days, dealing with things like free testing and paid sick leave amid the coronavirus crisis. This was the second big piece of legislation that Congress has passed and that's going to the president for his signature. And now they're talking about a third, which would actually have a much higher price tag. This one has been priced at around $1 trillion or more. And the Senate is taking that up this week. The House is not in Washington. The House passed its bill on sick leave and free testing and then went home. The Senate is here, so they'll act first on this big stimulus package. And then we'll have to see about getting the House back into town. There's all sorts of like logistical issues and practical issues and health issues involved in just Congress doing its business and getting these votes done. So that's part of kind of the surreal atmosphere we're seeing in Washington right now. But it's a pretty volatile and pretty difficult and complicated environment.
We'll get back to some of these stimulus ideas in just a bit. Let's talk about what you were just mentioning. Members of Congress are people. They're people who can be infected by this. And we're seeing some members of Congress self-quarantining at this point. A lot of elected officials are in high-risk category to be hurt by COVID-19. How is that affecting what's going on in Washington?
Well, again, the House isn't here. One of those self-quarantining lawmakers is Gwen Moore of Milwaukee. I haven't talked to her, but she announced that she's self-quarantining because of someone she came into contact with at an event. Ron Johnson had put out a statement days ago saying he was considering talking to a doctor about possibly self-quarantine because of someone he had come into contact with. He is not. I talked to him yesterday. I did a phone interview with him. He was in his Capitol office or his Senate office with just his chief of staff and nobody else. I mean, senators have sent staff members home to work from home. He described the Capitol as a ghost town, and he did so when I asked him about whether he had any concerns about working in the Capitol, and he said he didn't because it's so sparse right now. But you saw today with these votes in the Senate where they're now taking longer to vote because they're drawing out the roll calls so that senators, all 100 senators, aren't kind of crowding together at the same time. So this is another kind of logistical issue they're trying to work out. So it's a pretty challenging environment for everyone.
You mentioned that interview you did with Senator Johnson. He had been opposed to this sick leave proposal. What was his case to be made against that?
So he thought it would be much better in terms of getting cash to affected workers to kind of use the state unemployment systems as the vehicle, have the federal government basically make up the difference between your state unemployment benefits and the benefit in this bill, the enhanced benefit because of the coronavirus crisis. He called the mandates on small businesses to pay limited sick leave pay, salaries, a burden on small businesses. Some Republicans oppose that language, partly because they also, even though it was paid for in the bill with tax credits, they worried about whether those tax credits would get to businesses in time to help them shoulder the burden. So Johnson actually had an amendment today to kind of address that and to use his idea for helping workers, and it was mostly a party line vote. Under the rules, these amendments needed 60 votes to pass, and his got 50. He had two Democrats supporting his amendment and three Republicans opposed to it. It got 50 votes, which wasn't enough, so it didn't go into the bill, and he became one of eight senators on the final passage of the coronavirus relief package to vote no. It was a 90-8 vote.
Now, Craig, in that conversation with Senator Johnson, it got a lot of attention because of his messages on how seriously to take coronavirus. And you actually shared more context on your conversation with him. Can you talk about what he had to say?
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting conversation. He's made some comments in recent days that raised some eyebrows. I mean, to the effect of, maybe the media should be paying more attention to all the people that survive coronavirus, along with the stories about the people that are hospitalized and die. And he made some similar comments to me in this interview, where he said, it's not a getting coronavirus is not a death sentence, except for maybe no more than 3.4% of the people that get it, and that, you know, between 1% and 3% of people die, but, and that's obviously devastating, but 97% to 99% survive, and we don't shut down our economy because tens of thousands of people die on the highways or die from the common flu. So the interesting thing about these comments, I mean, even, you know, one interesting thing is that they're, you know, they will strike, and they do strike some people as kind of either insensitive or cold or just playing down the crisis. He was very emphatic about the idea that that's not what he was trying to do, and that he supports social distancing and supports the steps that governors are taking. He would not say the implication of some of these comments is that we're sort of overreacting to this, but he said that was not his intent, that he's just trying to kind of keep things in perspective and keep both the health crisis in perspective and also what's happening to our economy in perspective. But again, I think a lot of people are going to read those comments differently.
That's Senator Johnson. Can you talk about what some of the other members of Wisconsin's congressional delegation are doing, proposing in the Capitol when it comes to coronavirus reaction?
Yeah, so I'm planning on talking to Senator Baldwin tomorrow in more detail about some of her proposals. She obviously voted for the package today, and has a very, I would say, kind of a different approach and a different outlook than Senator Johnson, as we've seen on other issues. The House had just voted, you know, in the early morning hours this past Saturday. Then they kind of finalized the bill on Monday with some technical changes. The interesting thing about the House vote was that it was only 40 House members in the entire House voted against that legislation, but all four Republicans from Wisconsin voted no. And again, they had similar objections, similar to Senator Johnson's, to the way kind of to the paid leave, sick leave mandates in the bill. They also complained that the bill was rushed and that they had questions about what was actually in the bill. They didn't have enough time to read it. And so so you did have every Republican in the House, in the congressional delegation from Wisconsin, opposing these measures, which in this case, it was a measure that was negotiated by Democrats in the House, but with the Trump White House. So it had the support of President Trump, and that's why it got a majority of Republicans in the House around the country to vote for it. But again, Wisconsin's House members were pretty emphatic about their concerns about how small businesses would be able to handle the sick leave mandates, and also about just the way it was passed and the speed with which it was passed.
We're talking to Craig Gilbert right now, Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief. We're looking at the many aspects of the federal response to the COVID-19 crisis, including, we'll get into some more of these proposals for economic relief. We want to hear from you about that at 800-642-1234. Have you heard what you think are good or bad ideas coming out of Congress, the White House, or federal agencies? What do you think of the idea, as just passed, extending more sick leave to more people in response to the crisis? Do you think that's an overreaction? What about the ideas of direct payments, quick ones potentially, to Americans? How about support for small businesses, places like restaurants and other businesses that are hit hard by these closures? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Craig Gilbert right now. He's the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel Washington Bureau Chief. We're looking at the many aspects of the federal response to the COVID-19 crisis. Craig, let's turn in a little more detail to some of what we talked about earlier, economic stimulus, economic reactions to the damage caused by coronavirus, stock market going down, businesses closing. What kind of things are on the table right now?
So we don't know what this legislation is going to look like, but there's discussion of direct cash payments to a very broad, you know, slice of the American public. There's also talk about how to help businesses that are distressed, and there's talk about, you know, possible bailouts to specific industries like the airlines. So there's going to be debates about all three of those things. There's going to be differences, some partisan and some just individual, about, you know, what the best way to do this is. I mean, there is some common ground, and I think there is some real legitimate effort in both parties to try to find some common ground given the circumstances. I mean, I think everybody understands this is an extreme situation, and most members of both parties, you know, believe that the economy needs a massive infusion and that people need a lot of help.
Now we've got Diane with us in Partyville. Diane, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up? Good. What did you want to tell us about, Diane?
I got hit by a hammer. I run a small bar and grill in Partyville, Wisconsin, and I'm smart enough to know that it was coming down the pike, you know? And when the word went out on Illinois, like the night before, I pretty much figured Evers was going to shut us down on St. Patty's Day itself. So I kind of went on social media and said I was only going to do curbside only. So, you know, I ran into a few problems with that. I started thinking, how am I going to, three people, run this food out on, you know, corned beef and cabbage day? So I put my stools up, every other stool on the bar, allowed space between customers, just so people could walk into my building and pick up a to-go, because I didn't know how that was going to work, you know? So
Diane,
that is what I did.
Thanks a lot for the call. And Craig, there's a lot of people in Diane's position, people who own especially small bars and restaurants and the people who work for them. What kind of talk is there in Washington for people in that situation? What kind of, what kind of help is out there?
Yeah, I mean, it's really wrenching because, you know, the effects are so acute and they're so broad. And so obviously we talked about distressed industries, but this is affecting everybody, and, you know, down to the smallest level in terms of businesses, you know, bars, restaurants, shops, everything. So this is going to be, you know, a subject of a lot of discussion. There's talk about, you know, loans, you know, federally guaranteed loans. There's talk about allowing businesses to defer their estimated tax payments. There's talk about allowing businesses to defer the withholding they pay on payroll taxes. So there's a lot of discussions about ways to just kind of relieve the pressure on businesses by, you know, deferring some of their obligations, including to the federal government, and then maybe finding, you know, creating sources of credit for them to get over the hump.
We heard from a listener who emailed, my daughter and fiance are in the service industry in Chicago. Both jobs are in hiatus. Support from the government for their small business should happen now. And I want to key in on that last word there, Craig, now. These are big, complicated bills, and to have an impact, I think people are saying they have to happen pretty quick. Is there a sense of urgency?
There is that sense of urgency, but it's also running up against the kind of practical difficulty of just turning this thing on a dime. Again, part of it is, you know, there are familiar kind of philosophical and political differences between the parties about the best way to do it. Again, I think that most lawmakers are approaching that with goodwill, and we saw, you know, common ground arrived at with this sort of, with the first two big pieces of legislation that have been passed on this. But it's complicated, and it's going to, you know, the House, again, is not in Washington. The Senate is. So you've got to get a House send-off, you know, check-off on whatever the Senate does. And then there's just the machinery of government and the amount of time it takes, you know, if it's the IRS or whoever it is that's going to be, you know, the agency sending out checks to people to make that happen. So it's not going to happen immediately. Hopefully it happens sooner rather than later.
Speaking of that send checks to people idea, we saw Senator Mitt Romney was the first prominent Republican to talk about that. And now there's talk of one $1,000 check or maybe two, one per month. Where is that? Is that something that there's actual legislation going on right now?
Well, this is, you know, where we're at is kind of in the early stages of putting together this stimulus package, which is the $1 trillion plus, you know, attempt to really, you know, get help to people and stem the bleeding, the economic bleeding. So that's what's on the table now. They just finished this other piece of legislation, got that out of the way. You know, Republicans had obviously a lot of Republicans had objections to certain parts of the bill that the House passed, and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, just made the decision that the simplest thing to do is to get it passed and then deal with everything else in the third bill, which is what he's doing now. So there's the Democrats, led by Chuck Schumer, are tossing around ideas and putting together their approach, and the Republicans are doing the same thing. And the White House is there kind of negotiating.
Talking to Craig Gilbert from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's the Washington Bureau Chief there. It's our weekly roundup of big news in national politics. Let's turn to this minor story that's also going on, Craig. The presidential election, we had some primaries actually go through this week. Ohio postponed theirs at the last minute. What did we see from the states that did vote?
So we did see some confusion, involving trying to stage an election in the middle of this public health crisis, which certainly depressed election day, voting, in-person voting in some of these states. Mail picked up the slack in some states, but not so much in others. You had Ohio, this 11th hour decision to cancel the election that created a lot of confusion. So this is part of the election landscape now, but in terms of the actual results, we saw Joe Biden kind of continue his march to the Democratic nomination, winning Arizona, Illinois, and Florida by double digits, and winning very broadly. And so the spotlight is a little bit on Bernie Sanders in the coming days. His campaign put out a statement saying he's going to talk to his supporters, consider where to go from here. He was buttonholed, I think, on the Hill by a reporter today, and he said reports that he's pulling out of the race are not true. Don't believe them. Don't believe them. And then he also said, when he got asked by someone else about his plans, he said, I'm dealing with a global health crisis. Is that enough on my plate? Do I have to decide on my candidacy today? Something to that effect. So all of that is going on. Again, the intersection of the campaign and the pandemic. But the one sort of point of clarity in all that, I mean, you can imagine what this would look like if the Democratic race was still kind of wide open and a multi-candidate field. The chaos that we'd see in terms of trying to figure out, the fight toward the Democratic nomination with all the disruption of the pandemic and the election process. But we don't have that because Joe Biden is got a pretty secure delegate lead, and most people think this race is more or less decided.
We've got currently we still have scheduled our Wisconsin presidential primary plus the election for the state Supreme Court, a lot of local elections in that too. But it sounds like, Craig, we may not have a lot to choose from when it comes to that presidential primary by April 7th.
Yeah, so the first question is the election going to be held as scheduled? The second question is, if it is held as scheduled, in terms of the presidential primary, will Bernie Sanders still be in the race? The third question is, if all of that happens, what kind of a campaign are we going to see when, there's really no personal campaigning and no events and no rallies and no in-person field organizing and none of the trappings of a traditional campaign? And then, you have this dilemma that other states have tackled of, trying to pit the interests of keeping our democratic function, our democracy functioning with this essential, act of an election, and this public health crisis where you don't want people infecting each other, going to the polls on election day. And this, in this state-by-state debate and decision-making, we've seen a bunch of states postpone their primaries, which has had the weird effect of kind of clearing out the primary schedule for Wisconsin. Wisconsin's really the only big contest in the next 6 weeks, the way things stand. There's some small caucuses, Alaska, Hawaii, and Wyoming. So if Bernie Sanders stays in the race, it's kind of all about Wisconsin, if you think it's much of a race. On the other hand, it's not just a presidential primary in Wisconsin. It's a general election for offices like state Supreme Court, Milwaukee mayor. So it's not as simple for Wisconsin to postpone its election as it
and
is.
We'll have
for
to
some.
Jump in and leave it there. Craig, thanks for joining us. That's Craig Gilbert, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington bureau chief. He joined us for a weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics, the election race, and, of course, coronavirus response in the nation's capital. There isn't a lot of sports news out there right now, with many events and tournaments being canceled. But how's this for a headline? The UW Badgers men's basketball team wins the NCAA championship. Did that actually happen? Not in the real world, no. But some news and sports outlets are running simulations of the tournament and what could have been. In a simulation run by ESPN, the 17th-ranked Badger men took it all the way. I don't know exactly how the simulation works on a technical level, but they run apparently game-by-game matchups in the brackets. They don't show us final scores, though. According to the simulation, the Badgers won their way into the finals, where they beat BYU to bring home the title. Marquette also had a good run in that simulation. They made it to the Sweet 16 before getting eliminated by Wisconsin. Can we celebrate this virtual championship? I think we can. But as the Wisconsin State Journal reports, we'll have to ignore a different simulation from NBC that shows Wisconsin getting knocked out in the first round. Probably some, I don't know, bad programming, garbage in, garbage out, as they say. It's all the sports news that isn't. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.